This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 29, 2004. Back at the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The French left deals the conservative French government a serious blow as it sweeps regional elections. Today, the US Senate begins debate on the reauthorization of the Welfare Act. And the Puerto Rican community in New York and activist communities around the country mourn the passing of one of its greatest leaders, Richie Perez.
Richie was almost as like a father figure in a lot of our lives.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. soldiers shut down a newspaper in Baghdad, justifying the action as a much-needed part of creating a free Iraq. Reporting from Baghdad, Aaron Glantz has more.
The editor of one of Iraq's leading Shiite newspapers says dozens of American troops surrounded his paper's office, ordered the staff out, and padlocked its door. The charge, according to a letter from U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, what he called fake articles that incite violence against occupying troops and Iraqi citizens that support them. Among the articles mentioned by the American administrator, one that bore the headline, "Bremer Follows in the Steps of Saddam Hussein." Before being shut by the American army, the newspaper served as a voice of the movement of the firebrand young Ayatollah Muqtadar al-Sadr, who regularly preaches against the occupation and who last Friday used his sermon to link America's tactics in Iraq with Israel's assassination of Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
A United Nations report critical of UN operations in Iraq leading up to the bombing that killed 22 people last summer may lead to firings and demotions at headquarters. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
Last year, 3 months after the bombing of the UN headquarters in Baghdad, Secretary General Kofi Annan had appointed an accountability panel to investigate the role of individuals and entities in the security of the UN operations in Iraq. Releasing the report here today, a non-spokesman said some senior UN officials in Baghdad appeared to be blinded by the conviction that UN staff and installations would not become a target of attack, despite the clear warning to the contrary. After the bombing, UN officials blamed the US forces for failing to protect the UN building, but U.S. authorities said their offers to provide security were turned down by the U.N. officials, who apparently did not want to be seen as collaborators. I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Arab Summit League plans to work towards stability in Iraq and Israeli-Palestinian relations dissolved amidst controversy over too much U.S. influence in the region. Ula Al-Farawati reports from Amman, Jordan.
The Arab Summit, which has been scheduled to take place in Tunisia yesterday, has been cancelled. Informed sources have indicated that the cancellation comes under the request of the U.S. and Israel, especially after the targeted killing of Hamas chief Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Egypt has offered to hold the summit, but Tunisia still insists on holding it. Arab League Secretary General Amer Moussa told a press conference that the summit will convene in the coming few weeks. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, judges in New York City, San Francisco, and Lincoln, Nebraska are considering the constitutionality of the ban on late-term abortions. More from Kelly Ramirez at KPFA in Berkeley.
The Department of Justice is defending the Partial Birth Abortion Act in three federal courts. DOJ argues that the procedure, known officially as DNX, and used in a small minority of second and third trimester abortions, is never medically necessary. Opponents of the ban, such as Planned Parenthood and the National Abortion Federation, say that the law is too broad because it contains no exception to save the life or health of the mother, and that the law is too vague because it can be interpreted to ban the more common and less controversial D&E procedure. In 2003, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued a statement saying it continued to object to legislators taking any action that would supersede the medical judgment of a trained physician. The U.S. Supreme Court, which struck down a similar Nebraska law in 2000, is expected to eventually rule on the federal law. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Companies poised to handle the Medicare drug discount cards also have close ties to the Bush administration. Darby Hickey has more from the D.C. Bureau.
The healthcare companies providing the discount cards are the real beneficiaries of the program, says Larry Noble of the Center for Responsive Politics.
These companies have contributed more than $2.5 million to candidates and political committees so far in this election cycle. About 71% of those contributions went to Republicans. President Bush's campaign got about $275,000 of that. They clearly want to make sure that they have a seat at the table when the decisions are made about Medicare, and also they've been very generous up to now in making campaign contributions to ensure that the legislation got passed in a form that they liked.
The companies contributing the most to the Bush campaign were Blue Cross Blue Shield, WellPoint Health Networks, and the United Health Group. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The French left dealt the conservative French government a serious blow yesterday in regional elections as it won nearly 50% of votes, gaining the presidency in 20 out of the 22 regions in mainland France. The National Front, the extreme right-wing party, gained only 12% of the vote. As Raphael Kraft reports from Paris, the results of this election send a clear message to the French leadership that their hard-line policies are not popular.
Il appartient maintenant à la majorité de tirer les conséquences.
The ruling majority should draw conclusions from the results of a local election that yet has an unquestionable political dimension, said Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy yesterday night after the closing of polling stations. A big swing for the left. The right has been knocked out, were headlining French media this morning to describe the results of the French regional elections. The socialist-led opposition won in 20 out of 22 regions in mainland France. Socialist Member of Parliament Julien Drey describes the message given by French voters.
I remember this sentence by François Mitterrand, the former French socialist president I heard when I was young, saying, large victories are always the most difficult to deal with. And this morning I think of him because there are a lot more responsibilities for us regarding the expectations expressed in the polls. People turn toward us saying, we give you a new chance, but you mustn't disappoint us.
This election comes after a number of unpopular measures taken by the right-wing government, leading to a series of protests by teachers, public sector scientists, hospital workers, and more. The vote looked like a midterm referendum against French Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin's government. Jean-François Barouin is the spokesperson of French President Jacques Chirac's UMP party.
Maintenant, la question qui est posée et qui semble tout de suite être posée.
Today, the question asked is, should we stop reforms? It is also what the left asks for. No, French people didn't say in this election that reform should be stopped. The French society is fragile. It is a scared society, which means that the methods we use to achieve the necessary reforms should be adapted to this mood. Because if the answer means no reforms, it means more tax, more debts, less growth, less investments, which in the end means more unemployment.
Ségolène Royal is the big winner of Poitou-Charentes region, considered to be the stronghold of Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin. After such a blow, should the Prime Minister resign, she is asked.
It's not my problem. It's the president's responsibility to push for change in his government's politics. He should do what he was asked to do when he was elected, which is to protect the French welfare state, protect the more fragile citizens. He should fight for jobs and shouldn't let the social protection system be dismantled, because this creates social insecurity.
The victory of Ségolène Royal over Raffarin's protégé in Poitou-Charentes is a symbol. And again, speculations resurface over the Prime Minister's resignation. A number of ministers and politicians have been seen entering Jacques Chirac's presidential palace this afternoon. If the government is to be reshuffled, Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy, known for his toughness on crime, is the best rated for taking Jean-Pierre Raffarin's office. But his relationships with Jacques Chirac are conflictual. And it seems French voters felt more threatened by the calling into question of their welfare and public systems rather than by crime. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
Today, the U.S. Senate begins debate on the reauthorization of the Welfare Act. Provisions within the reauthorization would increase the number of hours that welfare recipients must work, and the Bush administration wants to include over $1 billion to encourage poor people to marry. The fate of the reauthorization is uncertain as Senate Democrats try to attach amendments to it that would raise the minimum wage and extend unemployment benefits. Our DC editor Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
For the past year and a half, Congress has been unable to agree to a reauthorization of the Welfare to Work Act, and so has continued to pass temporary extensions of the 1996 law, with a current extension expiring on Thursday. On Monday, the Senate began its debate on the measure, and Republican leaders hope to vote on it by the end of the week. The sponsor of the reauthorization, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, spoke on the Senate floor.
Despite dire predictions to the contrary, the reforms in the 1996 Act have produced very positive results. The welfare caseload has dropped dramatically. Between fiscal year 1997 and fiscal year 2002, the average monthly number of welfare recipients fell by 5 8/10 million, or 53% of the previous high.
This year, the House of Representatives has already passed its version, which includes provisions to increase mandatory work hours for participants from 30 hours to 40 hours a week. The Senate version, as of now, would increase work requirements to 34 hours. Gwendolyn Mink with the Welfare Made a Difference campaign says the increase of required work hours is a punishment for single mothers.
What underlies this problem is the refusal to understand that what mothers do raising children and caring for children is work. And that most mothers, in fact, with young children do not work outside the home 40 hours per week precisely because of the work burden of caring for and raising families.
However, the Republican congressional leadership and the White House say that they have a plan for single mothers. Again, Senator Grassley.
This legislation does and should do things to emphasize the importance of people who are in a married relationship, of less apt to be on welfare.
The White House was successful in getting both the House and the Senate to adopt its Healthy Marriage Initiative into the Welfare Reauthorization Act that will put $1.5 billion to encourage people who receive assistance to marry. Gwendolyn Mink says the proposal is the Republicans' way of diverting money from needed aid to their own priorities, such as marriage.
A mother would not need TANF if she were married. It's sort of a reversion to the male-headed patriarchal household in which the man supports his family. That's literally the language of the Bush administration through his own wage work. And it's a very dangerous aspect of this policy, and it's a waste of federal money, which could well be spent on child care, on education, on creating programs and services to enable women to overcome barriers to employment, such as domestic violence.
The passage of the Welfare Reauthorization Act may be difficult as Democrats plan to introduce a series of contentious amendments to the act. Some include raising the federal minimum wage, extending unemployment benefits, and reversing a Department of Labor's overtime rule change. Another amendment by Democratic Senator Bob Graham of Florida would allow some immigrant pregnant women and children to be eligible for Medicaid. However, immigrant rights advocates worry that another immigrant population, seniors and people with disabilities who fled persecution in their own countries, may lose their Social Security income. Tanya Broder is with the National Immigration Law Center.
The Social Security Administration has projected that thousands of refugees and other humanitarian immigrants could lose their SSI assistance in the coming months. These are people who have, who were granted the status more than 7 years ago. These are seniors and people with disabilities who rely on their grant in order to remain in housing and to buy basic necessities.
President Bush has proposed extending the benefits by 2 years. Immigrant rights activists are hopeful that Congress will follow his lead. I'm Mitch Jeserich for Free Speech Radio News.
The Puerto Rican activist community is today mourning the passing of one of its greatest leaders, a lifelong campaigner for peace, justice, and independence for Puerto Rico, Richie Perez. This Saturday, the former Puerto Rican young lord and community activist died in a New York hospital from cancer. WBAI's Sally O'Brien brings us this audio obituary for Richie Perez.
Veteran Puerto Rican activist Richie Perez died Saturday morning at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in Manhattan. He was 59 years old. A leader in the Puerto Rican movement, Richie spent his life fighting for human rights and social justice. Born and raised in the South Bronx, his activism began in 1965 in the movement for community control of schools. He was a member of the Young Lords Party, editor of its weekly newspaper, Palante, and deputy minister of information. He also fought for the freedom of the five Puerto Rican nationalist prisoners and co-founded the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights. In recent years, Richie Perez served with Jessica San Clemente as co-chair of the National Congress's Justice Committee. All the while, he also worked as director of community development for the Community Service Society, where over the last decade, his projects registered more than 150,000 new voters. For those who worked alongside him, he was a mentor, comrade, and friend. Panama, Vicente Alba.
We like to honor Richie's life by continuing on the struggle that he has led jointly with Ms. San Clemente, Jessica, around police brutality, with our involvement in putting an end to the global terror war of Bush, and fighting for global justice around the world, which is what Richie was about and continues to be about, because Richie lives in all of us.
Luis Garden Acosta. Mm-hmm. I met Richie the day that we both responded to the fact that the police had entered a church and beaten people to within an inch of their lives. There was blood all over what we call now the People's Church in East Harlem. And that was in December 1969. And the Young Lords Party, and Richie and I both went to respond and support to that. And the fact of the matter is that all of us in the human rights and social justice movement need mentors. When the entire world is telling you to do something else, you need people who are visionaries and who can inspire you through their principled practice, their continuous practice.
This is David Galarza. Something that Panama frequently mentions is that Richie has been the most consistent warrior that he knows, and that I know, who's been out there at the forefront of the struggle for people's liberation, regardless of their race or ethnic background. And most recently, despite the fact that nobody knew about his cancer, you talked about Brooklyn. He was out there for the Acosta family that had been brutalized on the 4th of July of last year, with a 62-year-old grandmother who had been nearly sexually assaulted by police officers from the 72nd Precinct in Brooklyn. And he went out there and he marched with us with his cane, and you knew that he was in pain, but he was there. He was presente to the end.
Jessica San Clemente.
Richie was almost as like a father figure in a lot of our lives. Several conversations have occurred before his passing recently about just how important it is for young people to realize that this election's coming up. And I mean, people don't really realize that Richie, in the hospital was discussing how we needed to mobilize, how we need to put people into registering to vote and to come out to the polls and to be exactly a human activist and to realize that we are not only citizens of the United States. He always said this. He always said we're citizens of the world.
Thank you. Coming out in the cold and the rain. See, because it doesn't matter, because when they stop you on the street, they stop you when it's cold and rainy too. So we can't be like the only time we're going to protest is when the sun is out, because that's not the only time abuses are made against us. What happened to them because of the group that they belong to. They happened to them because they're Latino, because they're black, because they're Asian, because they're young, because the police thought they didn't have any rights, because the police thought that they were second-class citizens, because the police thought that they could get away with doing this to them. And part of our mission, part of our obligation is to say, no, you can't do it like that. It can't be like that. That we can't allow people to be alone in these kind of situations.
Richie Perez, Presente. I'm Sally O'Brien.
At the EU summit, which just wrapped up, leaders of the European member states agreed to finalize an EU constitution by mid-June. One of the sticking issues in coming to an agreement on a common constitution is the issue of voting rights. Going against the other EU countries, Spain and Poland wanted the voting system that was adopted at the Nice 2000 meetings as part of the Nice Treaty. However, after the Madrid bombings and with the new Spanish government, there are signals that Spain is now willing to compromise. And as Danuta Zafranik reports from Warsaw, it seems Poland is now facing the heat alone.
On Friday, European Union members concluded a two-day meeting in Brussels. Although there was a unanimous agreement of the overall goals of the Brussels agenda, the summit revealed major divisions between old and new member states. Along with several other new member states like Hungary and Slovakia, Poland expressed its concern in preserving voting rights in a Council of Ministers under the 2000 Nice agreements. Under the Franco-German double majority voting proposal, Poland would be allowed fewer votes. Jacek Sariusz-Wolski, Poland's former chief negotiator, believes that the country should continue to defend a system which is beneficial to its interests.
We can say that Poland is giving up on the Nice Treaty. It is a bad decision to follow Spain, which is not sure what its stance will look like. Poland should have its own position and not give up now.
Also on the agenda was the issue of creating new anti-terrorism measures aimed at improving police and intelligence cooperation and tracking internet and cellular phone use by suspected terrorists. Spain was a partner with Poland in refusing to accept the new voting measure, but following the Madrid bombing and the election of a new socialist party, Poland was faced with tackling the voting issue alone. Cornelius Ochman from the Bertelsmann Foundation.
First of all, terrorist attack in Madrid changed the landscape of the European security. It's the second point. The designated Prime Minister of Spain, Mr. Zapatero, changed the Spanish position. So there is a risk of isolation.
Warsaw understood that it could not afford such a risk and expressed readiness to accept the Franco-German voting proposal, although it gives the country fewer votes and less power to block union decisions. This compromise was welcomed in Brussels, which hopes that the new stance will help relations between the European Union members, which soured due to the war in Iraq. Several opposition leaders stressed that although Poland will no longer enjoy the power it was given in the Nice Treaty, at the end of the day, it stands to gain by learning to practice the art of compromise. In Warsaw, I'm Danuta Szafraniec, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A new University of California proposal may disallow the funding of campus groups that organize around specific issues. The new fee proposals, which could take effect during spring break across University of California campuses, would eliminate the ability for student groups to go to the student populace for more money, effectively stopping the fundraising ability of issue-based groups. The proposals are pushed forward in the wake of much campus organizing to defeat Prop 54, which was the so-called Racial Privacy Initiative. The UC Office of the President holds the final decision-making power with regards to this fee proposal, as Katie Jarmel reports from Pacifica affiliate KCSB in Santa Barbara.
For over a decade, campus-based organizations have been able to petition the student population to ask for additional funding. If a majority of students vote in favor of funding a group, a fee, generally an additional dollar or two, is added onto a student's registration costs and earmarked for the group. These student funding measures are called referenda. Referenda are used to fund groups, not campaigns, but specific student organizations can use their decision-making processes to work on campaigns for California ballot initiatives. The new proposal from the UC System's Office of the President would change all of that. This proposal was started after the Southworth versus the University of Wisconsin case, which determined that group funding cannot be based on a group's point of view. Rob Thompson of the Boston, Massachusetts-based Center for Campus Free Speech elaborates on the ruling.
There's a pro-choice and a pro-life group coming up for funding. I can't say I'm pro-life or I'm pro-choice, so I'm not going to give the other side funding. In that respect, that would be viewpoint discrimination.
The university argues that if referenda are the sole means of funding, an unpopular group on campus would be disenfranchised because they would not be able to garner enough support to get funding. However, student groups point out that referenda are used in addition to normal funding. Again, Rob Thompson.
Larger student organizations can put a question on the ballot asking the students if they agree to raise their student fees by $1 per student per semester. And then these fees will be earmarked for the specific organization that asked that question. So in this way, larger student organizations can subsist without jeopardizing the ability of smaller organizations to receive funding through the normal process.
The new fee policy also prohibits student governments from lobbying that is not directed at a public official. Because many California ballot initiatives have significant effects on budget and student issues, this leaves no channels for student governments to oppose or support significant measures that may affect their schools. UC Berkeley Graduate Assembly President Jessica Quindell relates how this has affected the lobbying that her organization worked on regarding Proposition 54. an initiative which would have eliminated the ability to collect data or do research with regards to race.
The reality is that anything we do is educational, and the point of student government is to be educational, and to say that some kind of lobbying is educational and other kinds of lobbying is not is really a false distinction. Where are you drawing that line? They're not claiming that working on ballot initiatives is not educational. They are claiming that it is educational, but that only registered campus organizations can do it, not student governments. The reason they're saying that is that student governments are a unit of the university. In their policies, they're clearly stating that the positions of student governments are different and not the same and should not be construed as representing the university's position.
The Office of the President, or UCOP, didn't return phone calls by airtime. However, the UCOP has the final say in how the fee policy is changed and is hoping to implement the new measure by fall 2004. Reporting from KCSB in Santa Barbara, this is Katie Jarmel for Free Speech Radio News.
Behind the coup d'etat in Haiti.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
Make no mistake, we are witnessing a coup taking place on the island nation of Haiti. The forced departure of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was something that the Bush administration has been trying to do for years. It saw the opportunity, and wham, it took it. Now it has installed a puppet as prime minister and tries to install a president to its liking. This is what American democracy means, the power to impose U.S. imperial will on a sovereign nation. Several years ago, writers for the Haiti Progrès newspaper wrote, quote, "The destabilization campaign against the Haitian government is being led by the Bush faction of the U.S. bourgeoisie, which is arch-reactionary and hostile to regimes which even pay lip service to a progressive agenda, as Aristide once did." Haiti Progrès newspaper published this article in October 2002. They warned that the elements of the Haitian bourgeoisie would ally themselves with their very rivals, the land-rich Grandons, and the latter would bring forth the same forces that held sway under the Duvalier dictatorship. Lo and behold, within days of the coup d'etat against Aristide, who emerges but Gerard Letortue, a man who served as ambassador in the short-lived military-backed government of Leslie Maniga back in 1988. Maniga was overthrown by General Henri Namphy some 6 months after his term began. Now, a face from that government is installed as PM. And what are his first words? Bring back the army. He has called Aristide's disbanding of the army unconstitutional. We're now watching the reemergence of neo-Duvalierists who want to reinstate the power of the Macoutes. The Bush regime calls this democracy, but the Haitian people have another idea. They have seen the U.S. come in before using words like democracy and saw instead occupation and humiliation. Haiti is facing dire times as the Grandons and the bourgeoisie launch another war of exploitation against the Haitian poor. And that's what it's all about. Who will profit from the exploitation of the Haitian peasantry? Who shall rule? The U.S. seems determined to make sure that the Haitian people will have little say in the matter. That's why they sent Aristide into a forced exile, the man who won some 85% of the Haitian people's vote. Down with U.S. meddling. Let the Haitian people govern themselves. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. FSRN is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.